Walt Rosette, who went over here. We have Bob Hitchcock, who was a radio operator for not only our 306 bomb group, but for a couple of other bomb groups. And he has some interesting stories to tell about. He was one of those guys that was involved with early radar and radio jamming and things like that. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to these gentlemen, and they're each going to spend 10 minutes or so talking about their stories. And what they did and what they experienced. You know, we have another guy who's joining us here. This is Nick Sawicki, and he also flew his missions over Germany as a gunner in a B-17. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to these men, and they'll spend a few minutes telling their stories. And when they're done, I'll just open it up to questions, and we can just have a good time. And if you would just hold the ball kind of towards your mouth, Mr. Beezer tells me that's how it works the best. So I'll turn it over to Bob first, and we'll go from there.
You want me to stand up?
No.
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 Okay, folks. I'm Bob Hitchcock. I was a radio operator. I got to England in June 1944. I was with the 303rd Bomb Group then. I flew seven missions with them. That was my original crew that I had trained with in America. And my ball turret gunner was killed on mission seven. So I got to experience not only combat, but how it is to die in combat, because being a radio operator, I could look right back and see the ball turret. And Mac was a wonderful young man. He was from Lake Charles, Louisiana. He was married, and I met his wife just before we left the state. And so I flew seven missions with them, and my pilot came into the barracks one day and told me that I had been chosen to lead the crew and go to a little school put on by the RAF to study radar. Radar was new then. And so I left Molesworth, where the 303rd was. I left to go to Alton. O-U-L-T-O-N, little base there that had radar sets. The radar sets originally were quite large, and the B-17 wasn't large enough to accompany me and my radar set, so they sent me to a B-24 base. Well, I was a little bit upset about that. Naturally, I'm a B-17 man. But I told the driver of the truck, I thought he'd made a mistake. I said, those are B-24s out there. He said, so? I said, well, I don't know that plane. He said, well, you better learn pretty quick. That's where you're going to be flying. So I went down on the field and talked to some of the ground crew, and I asked them where I would be flying. And they said, well, that's the problem. We were trying to figure out where we can put you because the crew are occupying all their positions. But we're thinking of tying the two rear doors shut, the two rear bomb bay doors, so they won't open. And put the plywood platform in there with you and your jamming set, because I was jamming German radar. So that's where I flew, in the bomb bay. Now, it was really a predicament spot to be in because freezing cold down there. I didn't have any way to plug into anything. I did have oxygen. But as a result of my attempt to try to do my job down there, I was just shuddering from the intense cold, because every time they'd open the other set of bomb bay doors, that minus 40 degree would hit me. But anyhow, I managed, and at first we caught the Germans by surprise because they didn't know that we had that kind of equipment. And so I had a sweep band on my set where I could hear the German signal. I knew what frequency he was using. And all I had to do was flip a switch and my equipment would jam him. Now on his scope, he would see little graphs.
Closer to your mouth.
We've seen that many times.
Microphone.
Oh, and I forget about this thing. And so I had the opportunity to see what he was seeing. On this little graph, as soon as I jammed him, there'd be a big pip, and then that would be what he thought was my formation of planes that were coming to a bomb a target. Well, that was not true. It was just us, just one single V-24. So he was calling his superior officers to get the fighter planes to intercept our bomb group that he knew where we were. Well, it worked. It worked really well, and we saved a lot of lives, and we saved a lot of airplanes as a result of that. But they're no dummies. They caught on to what we were doing. And after 8 missions, they got us all together and told us that it's not working anymore. So we're sending you all back to B-17. Well, I thought I'd go back to the 303rd. Not so. I ended up at the 306th. And that's when I entered combat with all you fellas. And that was in March of 1945. See, that's only just 2 or 3 months before the war ended. But I flew 17 missions with you guys. And I have a record of all of the targets. But I don't remember, being an extra radio operator, I don't have any recollection of the pilots that I flew with. I know the date that I flew, I know the targets, I know the time in combat, but I don't know anything else. So I met a fella here who's gonna help me. And he's got all the records. And on one of those missions, we didn't make it back to Thurlai. We were in bad shape. And the pilot said, don't bail out. He said, we're down too low, and you won't have room for your chute to open. So we stayed with the plane. Well, we got down to one engine. The left side of the plane seemed to be the worst shot up because there was oil streaming back from number 2 engine. And he found that the navigator up in the front of the plane had spotted this little place where we could land. And this was in over the Rhine River into Belgium. Well, at the briefing that morning, that piece of ground actually was in enemy territory. So I was thinking, well, we're going to be taken prisoner. Not so. Our forces had pushed the Germans back to the Rhine, and that was in friendly territory. So when we hit the ground, the left side of the plane, that left tire was flat, and the wingtip hit the ground and bent the 2 propellers, and we made just a 180-degree sweep, and we were all okay. All 10 men, we survived just with no injuries. But the plane was in real bad shape. A lieutenant and the artillery, our American artillery, ran up to the plane and said, he very excited, he took the waste door and about jerked it off, and he said, get the hell out of here, that plane's on fire. Well, I didn't know what the heck he was talking about. I said, we're not on fire. He said, I'm not talking about you, I'm talking about that plane over there. Well, what had happened was, this little field was being used by P-47's Thunderbolt fighters guarding the last bridge over the Rhine at little town of Remagen. You probably remember in history, that was the last bridge. And he must have, in his panic, as he banked to come in, he must have saw this B-17 coming in and trying to get in ahead of us. And he overshot the runway and hit a dirt embankment and tipped up, but his plane caught on fire. Well, that's what the lieutenant was trying to tell us. And he said, get out of the plane and get in a hole. Keep your head down. That little 47 has got all of its ammo on board. And it's going to get hot enough and your shells are going to be flying. So I jumped in the first hole that I could find, which was full of rainwater. Now, this is in the winter time, and I was just so cold. I can remember just freezing to death in that hole. But I kept my head down. All the other guys found a hole to get in. And we waited. Pretty soon, boom, boom, boy, these 50 calibers are shooting all over the place. And it just riddled our B-17. Just shot it full of holes. Well, as things got worse, he told us, stay down because there's a 250-pound bomb underneath his fuselage. We got to wait for that to go. Well, when that bomb went off, boy, I tell you, I remember looking at the 17 and the other tire was going down. And by then the 17 was just setting real low. And so no way we would get back to Thurlai with that plane. Mm-hmm. But they waited till nighttime. It was around midnight when they got a driver to get us in a truck and got us to Brussels. And I got in a C-47 amongst some engine crates, aircraft engines. And we got back to England, but he didn't take us to Thurlai. He took us to someplace else, I don't remember where. And my pilot had to call Thurlai and get a truck. And they came and got us. Well, when I got to the barracks, the surprise of my life, there was my bunk, a bare bunk. My mattress was gone, all my uniforms, all my letters from home, everything was gone. And then I remembered, oh yeah, they thought I was gone. So one of the guys in the barracks said, you better go down to supply and get your stuff. Well, I never got it back because I had a lady do the pinstripes in my shirt and all of that, you know, so I had some swell equipment and I never got it back. Somebody else got it. So they had to reissue me everything. And but I finished up on April 14th was my last mission. And the war ended in May the 8th was the 8th. So I flew 17 missions with the 306, and I survived. And I'm here to tell you about it.
Okay, my name is Walt Rosette. I was a pilot in the 369th. I got over there in September of 44, flew my first mission in October, flew the first four missions as co-pilot, and that was very useful because it gave you an opportunity to look around and see what was going on. I got a little anxious as the fourth one came along that I wanted to get back with my crew and get on with the flying. And we did. I guess the next notable mission after the first one was in November of 1944. We were over the target and I got hit with a piece of flak about as big as my thumb. Came through the electrical instrument panel that was just left of the pilot's knee. And this piece of flak came through the seat of the airplane, and there fortunately were two of those yellow cushions on the plane, on the seat that day, and it broke all four sides of the two cushions. and hit me in the left rear cheek. And after, you know, you're wearing a flak suit and they have an oxygen mask and can't really get around, I went down, when we got down to 10,000 feet, I finally was able to get around and find out that I wasn't seriously wounded. But when we got to the channel, if you had a wounded on board, you had the opportunity to fly straight back to the base, which I dutifully did and saved an hour that way. And when you landed, if you had wounded on board, you shot off a red, red flare, and that got the ambulance to meet you. And my engineers, I had at that point decided that I really wasn't badly enough wounded to do anything, but my engineer said, look, this is the only time I'm going to have this opportunity. You got to let me shoot off the red, red. And I finally said, okay, and he shot off the red, red and every other flare we had in the plane. And they took me to the infirmary and put a Band-Aid on my left thigh that had been wounded with a piece of glass that came from the instrument panel. And I had a black and blue mark about that big on my rear end. And I was so badly wounded, on the following day I was scheduled to fly again. But many years later, earlier this century, I had a service-connected disability, not connected with anything like that. And the Veterans Service Officer thought I would have a little bit better relationship with the VA if I had a Purple Heart. And the Purple Heart was not anything you were awarded. You were entitled to it if you were wounded by enemy action and received medical attention, and I did. And 61 years after the fact, I had the Purple Heart pinned on me by a general in Woodland, California. The next notable mission was Christmas Eve in 1944. It was the Battle of the Bulge, and things were rather difficult. We had been kept on the ground for 2 weeks almost because of the weather, but they decided that we were either going to be able to get the 8th Air Force off the ground, or maybe we'd have to get out of Europe. And the net result was that I took off that morning. I could not see the wingtip of the airplane. The only instrument takeoff I ever really made. And my co-pilot was looking down at the runway to keep us on there, and I was looking at the instruments, and we made it off, but there were really more losses on takeoff that day than there were from enemy action. I then, in January of 45, became a lead pilot. The first lead mission I flew, we were after the Hohenzollern Bridge in Cologne, Germany, near the cathedral. And it was, we were trying to block the Germans from taking any of their equipment back over the Rhine. And we put the bridge in the water, and in due fashion, it looked like this in the water. And we did it that way because that was my initial W. But then in March 30th of 1945, we flew a mission to Vegesack, Germany, just outside of Hamburg, some submarine pens. We were carrying rocket-propelled bombs, one under each side of the wing, weighing 4,200 pounds apiece. We took off fully loaded with gas, and we were 5,000 pounds above the red line for the airplane. We made the first run. It was about 50% cloud covered. We had to bomb at exactly 20,000 feet. The bombardier lost the target at the last minute in some clouds, but they were on us on that run, and got our number two engine, made a second run, and it was a good run, but unfortunately on the first run they had gotten the bomb release mechanism and the bombs didn't go. Then the third run, the bombardier once again lost the target in the clouds, and finally on the fourth run we made the mission. It was the only time during the war that any lead plane had made four runs on the same target. Having lost the engine, we were using more gasoline than usual, and I said to the command pilot, I think maybe we ought to go to Germany, and he wanted to go back to England, and you know, he was in charge. So we went back to England, broke the squadron up in the middle of the North Sea there, and landed at the first base that we could land at in England. And when we got on the ground, we had 5 minutes of fuel left. So if we had to go around, we probably wouldn't have made it. The final mission that I flew before the end of the war was on May 2nd of 1945. And this is a week before the end of the war. There were no targets left to bomb. And instead of delivering bombs, we were delivering newspapers. And our first, these were barrel-like containers on parachutes. And our first stop was at Schweinfurt. And we dropped them. We were flying all by ourselves right on the ground, not with 1,000 other airplanes at 25,000 feet. But after the Schweinfurt, we went on to the prison camp at Buchenwald that had just been freed some 3 weeks earlier. And there was the grave opened with 1,000 bodies laying in it, and the survivors on the ground with arms like toothpicks waving to us. And it was one of the most emotional experiences of my life. It was the perfect way to end the war, because how many people I killed or what kind of damage I did on those first 33 missions I flew were very quickly justified. And if I could have got my hands on a German, I would have killed them. But it was the perfect way to end the war. And I then stayed on for the Casey Jones project, and we got through that until September. And September, I flew home the southern route, and that was that.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I was not a combat person, so I wonder why I'm sitting here. I was what they call a flying control officer, and I thought for a minute here I'd tell you how I got to do that. I was an aviation cadet in 1942. I lived in Baltimore, and they sent me to California right off the bat, to Oxnard, California, to learn to fly. I learned basic, I did very well. The last day of basic, I decided I'd play a little volleyball. I went up to, it was about a dozen of us on each side of that net, by the way. I went up and I caught an elbow right in the head. I lost all my depth perception, and knocked me out, completely out. So when I got to advance, I couldn't land a damn airplane. It saved my life, because they sent them all down to New Guinea, and about 95% of them are still down there someplace. Yeah. Anyway, when I was washed out, they sent you to an unsigned pool, and then you had to sign up for things and so forth, and then everything was turned down. And suddenly a major called me in, sat me down, we were talking and chatting, and he suddenly said to me, "Will you go overseas?" I said, "Yes." "We go over tomorrow?" "Yes." "How about right now?" And my answer was, it wasn't much difference between tomorrow and now. So he said, "You've been selected. We'll send you overseas. I can't tell you where you're going to go, can't tell you what you're going to do, but if you graduate, you'll be a second lieutenant." That was a gamble, believe me. So they sent me to England. They picked 75 of us. And by the way, out of that 75, only about 40, 45 of us got a commission. And we went to a place called Truleigh in Lancashire. And they parceled us out, two people to a various RAF bases. And if you imagine two brown uniformed guys and about 3,000 blue uniforms, it's a little hard to get along with that. But the course was so concentrated that we took a test. The final tests were 2 days of written tests for five subjects. And we wrote for 8 hours each day. And they had a control room, a mock-up control room with all the lighting in it and everything else. And it was bugged. Believe me, it was bugged. And the problem I got was a bombing raid. And as fast as you correct something, they throw something else at you. If what would take 15 minutes, they might give you about 30 seconds. And then after you finished all that, the tests and that thing, you met a board and they selected you. I was in front of the board about 10 minutes. Some of them were there for an hour and didn't get commissioned. Anyway, I was sent to Third Eye, and I enjoyed there. By the way, it was a wonderful place to be a flying control officer. And our jobs was not just takeoffs and landings. We had to keep that airfield in top shape. If it's winter time, we had to tell the pilots at briefing where the icy spots were, where it was sanded, and so forth and so on. If we found a bad place in the runway, we had to get the engineers in to correct it and things like that. This night flying, there was a certain things that the British had, lighting, that you could, you had to tell the pilot or the navigator where these lights were, so when they flew around England, they know exactly where they were. And my biggest problems there was perhaps the weather. As Walt here said, sometimes on takeoff, even the control tower couldn't see them. So we just took a happy look, thought that you were going to do all right. But the worst part was the weather when they came back. They had a buncher over near Oxford. Now, a buncher was a radio beacon, and it'd all fly to that, and it'd break the formation up and come back one by one. And you couldn't see the end of the runway sometimes, so you'd have to go out there with a microphone and stand on the end of the runway. And that's no fun for 36 shot up B-17s coming in. You never know when one of them is going to go that way or that way. And you had to be pretty quick on your legs sometimes. One of the jobs of the flying control officer was to brief before the missions. We had to line up in a proper takeoff order so that when they went to get information, it was easier for them. It saved them 15 minutes gasoline, which is a lot, wasn't it? Another thing we did was brief the pilots, new pilots, on the flying around England and particularly at Third Eye. I remember I briefed one guy, and after I briefed him by, you could see him sometimes on the other end of the main runway looking at this nice valley we had there. And this one guy went down the runway and he lost an engine. And he went out, we're all standing there waiting for an explosion. And it was, you've seen pictures of these Navy planes used to take off. They'd go down and come back up. And we didn't see anything. And what happened, the guy opened up his bomb bay, and the bombardier dropped the 10 500-pound bombs out there someplace, in trail. I don't think they ever found them. But that night at the mess, the guy thanked me for telling me how pretty his valley was, because that saves their lives. That's about all I have now. So I was a grounded person. It was a tough job. And I'm very pleased to say that I never turned in a pilot for bad flying, even though there were some. But you'd be surprised how many of our friends were settled down in the mess over a jar of scotch.
My name is Nick Sawicki, and I finished high school, and I was working out a little bit. And then the Japanese, they bombed Pearl Harbor. And then President Roosevelt, he declared war. And at that time, I was 19 years old. So I went to Syracuse, and I enlisted. And then after I took an exam there and a few other affairs, then they called me in and said, "You're going to go to the Army Air Force and come in, and we're going to send you down to Biloxi, Mississippi for a little training. And then from then on in, you're going to go to various schools all around the U.S. of A. to start learning things." So I was in that process, and during my process, I even was sent to Michigan State University for a month there of training and so forth. And then it was like everything else. Everybody else was pretty much getting their training and getting ready to assemble. But a lot of our training was pretty much, it wasn't 100% of the book. We went through the books, train, depth perception and everything else, but they were in a hurry. And maybe they go through 3/4 of the book and expect you to be able to do your job and know what's going on. And then when you get into the field, you'll really, that'll be on the job training. So that was the situation, getting started. And then I was probably one of the first people, soldiers, to be sent to Wendover for assembly. In the 306 bomb group, we had 4 squadrons. They started assembling the 423rd bomb squadron. And then there was a lot of assembly work going on. It wasn't just an airplane. It wasn't just a crew. There were people that had to load the bombs, people that had to load the ammunition, people that had to do the cooking, some people, the office personnel, they had to have those. So it wasn't an overnight thing. And our living conditions were not very good at Wendover. It was Tent City, as you call it, and a place for the cooks and the bottle washers could give us a little something to eat once in a while. And it was the situation out there at the time. The nights were cold. We didn't have enough blankets to take care of us. The days were hot. We didn't have any air conditioning or anything like that. We just had to go through that routine and for the assembly process. And then after a crew was assembled, the engineers would come in, the gunners, the navigators, bombardiers, and so forth. And there wasn't much field training. They didn't have 100 B-17s out there at the time. Maybe they had a few, and I suppose you could get 2 missions in out there. You were qualified, you know? That was the situation. And then when the crew was assembled, it wasn't a situation that that crew would get in an airplane and fly to England. A lot of them, some of them, maybe once in a while there would be a crew that could go to the eastern part of the United States and go up to the northern islands up there and head over to it. A lot of the personnel was shipped to New Jersey and the East Coast, and the Queenie Elizabeth was there. And that's how the majority of the personnel got over to England. And pretty much the case with the Queen Elizabeth is each room, they put additional beds on each wall that they could. You'd come in through the door, that was a different story. But the other three walls, they put additional beds there so that they could put maybe three, four, five, six, maybe eight or nine people in there. And each one had a level to sleep in, three levels. Maybe the top level, they'd go out for the first 8 hours to do their thing. After they got done, the second level would go out, do their thing, get their eating, get to whatever they need. Then the whoever's on the bottom would be the last group to get their service and look around and see what's going on. So, and there wasn't exactly a straight trip to England. I mean, majority of the people that were traveled on it in the past, it was a pretty much of a straight line. And you headed there, and you could maybe get there in a week's time or something. But with all the soldiers on there, and all the German submarines that were in the Atlantic Ocean, we had to, we took a trip of zigzagging. We'd go this way, we'd go this way, we'd go this way, left and right and so forth, to not get locked in on some of those German submarines. And we were fortunate, that system seemed to work, but it took us a little longer to get there. And that was a process of getting the 306 bomb group over there. It wasn't everybody that went via there, over there, via airplane, or something else. The Queen Elizabeth, they had to come back, pick up another group of 306 people, and finally we'd wind up in Queen Elizabeth come in Scotland, and then we'd be trucked down to England or get on a train or something like that down the Third Line. And then that's where the 306 really was able to assemble and start their missions, when all the personnel was there via ships or via air or whatever the system was. I think after the 306, we got older, there was more planes, I think, being built and so forth. And a lot of the airplanes came over with a crew. Some of them came over there with a partial crew. And the other system of getting over there was the women pilots. They ferried a lot of the B-17s to Europe. And a majority of them got through. Maybe once in a while one we could lose one, but that's the way we got our replacements a lot of time, was through all that system. And so then once we started flying and starting bombing, then I would say that was pretty much an everyday occasion. You'd either fly or maybe you wouldn't fly, but and as some of the people about them have spoken about, bad weather and cloudiness and so forth. Weather reports were important, and to get whether you'd even take off and go to the target and drop your bombs. So during that period, as happens in any occasions, you lose personnel, there'd be a lot of replacements happening for crew members. You go to the briefing, the target was set up, the alternate target was set up, and somebody, they're assembling the crews and says, all of a sudden some pilot says, well, I only got nine guys, I need another man. So there was always somebody around that they could send to the plane, whether he knew the position he was going in, was going to do or not, mainly to be there. And the big thing was to operate the guns. We had 50 caliber, 10 50 caliber machine guns. And so that was the situation at the early times. In the early times, the B-17, they were always sending back information. This doesn't work too good. Maybe you could revise this. Maybe you could do this to the B-17. And actually, in a way, the first people that started flying over there and bombing, they were also what you could call a guinea pig, experimental also. A plane could be built, Boeing could build it, send it over there, but there could be problems with it too, and there was always material being sent in for replacements. And I would say one thing, the people who worked in the Boeing industry, and they also sent us replacements, parts, and sent us over the B-17s. They were doing a very excellent job. And I give the home people a lot of credit for that. A lot of women were involved in that system, building ships and other things, and working in factories and so forth. I think probably that end of it was never exploited that much. I don't think the women ever got the credit that they should have got during World War II, but they did a real good job. That's what I can say on that part. Our first missions were all right. Germany was loaded with fighter planes. They were loaded with anti-aircraft guns and so forth. And the first years, the first missions there, maybe 6 months or so, we took our beating in a way, you know. But we continued. We were at the briefings every day, and that was the personnel. We had very good personnel. Everybody was willing to do the job, and everybody did their job the best they could. And myself, I completed my 25 missions, and I was the fifth person to complete 25 missions over there. And the other thing is the 306 bomb group. That was the first bomb group to bomb Germany, and I was in that group. So, and then after I got my 25 in, they sent me back, and I came to the United States back here, and I was an instructor, and I did the rest of my time in World War II being an instructor. So that's kind of a brief thing about my life and so forth. Thank you.
Okay. Why don't we just, at this point, just open it up for any questions that people have. I have another microphone here that... It does work. So, any questions? Sue?
This is for Bill. Did you have a story about somebody trying to steal a B-17 at one time?
Say that again.
Did you have a story about somebody trying to steal a B-17 taking off?
Not that I know of. I would like to say one thing about that course I had. When they finished up in that control tower, they had us so beat that there was a big explosion on the radio, and out came three RAF officers laughing like mad and told us we were all dead.
Okay, but
Mr. Hitchcock there, did they just train you on the jamming gear, or did you also get training on the H2S radar?
No, just the jamming.
Just the jamming gear? Yeah. Okay.
Bill?
Walt, I heard you talking the other day about how few planes you lost when you were leading missions. I wonder, What things did you attribute that to? Was it tight formation, or what kind of discipline did your group have to have that kind of success?
I think the first thing is luck. But I got over there in September of 44. The German Air Force had pretty much been destroyed at that point, and the P-51s were around, and we would see the contrails of the 51s fighting the Germans, but they were 50 miles away, and my gunners never fired a gun. It just worked out fortunately, and the 369th never lost an airplane on a mission I flew. Again, one more illustration of it's better to be lucky than smart.
I have a question for anyone who might know. I'm back in the back here. Rocky always told me stories about missions. He told me to go get a metal detector, and he says, go to Germany, and you'll find a lot of nickels. Why did you guys drop nickels? Do you know anything about it?
Well, nickels were not 5-cent pieces. Nickels were aluminum foil that were dropped essentially by P-38s in advance of the bombers coming over the target. So they sent out these thousands of pieces of aluminum foil that did distract the German radar. That was the purpose of the nickel.
I hadn't heard that before.
It's called chaff.
Yeah.
Chaff. Well, other questions?
Did you ever experience the 262, the Germans? Did you ever, the jet, the end of the war?
I saw a couple of contrails of the jets, and that was it. But I never did see a fighter plane close up.
Nick, you had a wonderful story. You didn't tell us what you did. What was your position?
I was the engineer, and I operated the top turret. That was my position. And the other thing is, the assembly for the 306 was early 1942. That's when we were out here assembling. And then I finished up in 1943, in the middle of 1943. And then that was the situation there.
Right. Other questions?
What's over here? For Nick, what was it like the day you guys found on 27 January 43? What was it like in the briefing when you found out you're going to bomb Germany?
Well, the situation, I would say, was we were a little tender at it, you know, and when that came out, it kind of froze us up a little bit. We went into the meeting, and the pilots were there, the whole crews were there, and then they would select a target for the day, and then the next thing they would do is select the alternate target for the day. So if because of the weather conditions and so forth, or maybe they had to take a different route or something, and we couldn't hit the main target, then we had a secondary target and to drop our bombs. Then the other thing is they established the lead pilot for our section. We'd have a lead pilot for the 423rd Squadron, we'd have a lead pilot for the 306 bomb group, and so forth. And so, and of course the lead pilot, he has some other responsibilities, I think, besides flying the plane. If you had wingmans out there and the guy's wandering around and I'm getting out there too far, the pilot would speak up and say, Joe, you'll get a little closer in here. We want a tight formation. So that kind of a thing happened that I think that the lead pilot on each squadron or for the group that had a responsibility to do. And that was in the briefing, you know, who's going to be the chief. And then they would, we got our briefing. That was probably the first thing we got. Then we go have breakfast. The second thing we do is we go pick up our equipment. I didn't have a parachute. Everybody had a parachute. The parachutes weren't in the barn and the planes. And that, and then the bombardier, he had to go, and we had to pick up the bomb site, the Norton bomb site. That was never left alone, the Norton bomb site. And if the plane was going down and on a mission, the first thing the bombardier had to do is destroy the bomb site. That was the number thing to do. You know, you couldn't take a chance that the plane might get along the ground or something and not damage the bomb site, because I don't think the Germans or the other people had such an advanced piece of equipment, and they were looking for it. And the bomb site, when the bombardier got in the plane, he had it with him. When the bombardier left the plane, he had it with him. And well, we had to go and distribute some of our stuff and send our parachutes back. And a lot of times the parachutes would go through a little check-in or something, you know. And then after the briefing, the trucks would come around and deliver us to our airplane. And we wait there for the different trucks that come around and deliver us to the airplane. Coming back, and we had no problems. We had a good bombing mission. We had to go to the debriefing. And you'd be there, you'd tell them how many fighters you saw. Well, how did the group look? Were the ones up above you, they look good and good tight, and were there, and the fighters, in order to take care of the fighters and so forth. And how was the aircraft? How many fighters did you see? Was there a lot of aircraft blasting around you? And how was that doing? That was in the briefing. And then the other thing would be, did you see a lot of fighter planes go down? Did we get a lot of them? Well, that was always a question mark, how many we got, you know, because we were tight groups. We were one above us, another group down below us, and so forth. Then that one plane that went down maybe could have been coming for three or four times, you know, and that needed a little justification. I think eventually they realized, you know, maybe our count isn't that good, you know, maybe we shouldn't rely on that too much, you know. And that was a situation when the debriefing. Then after the debriefing, we'd go get something to eat. We'd go back to the barracks, and majority of us would get under the blankets and go to sleep, because if there's a mission the next day, we had to be up at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. That was a wake-up call. And we went, dressed, got all our clothes, and we went, got some tea, and went through the system that we had to do. So that's some of the procedures and whatnot of the 306 bomb group in the 8th Air Force.
Got a question for Walt. Walt, as a lead pilot, where were you? Were you at the front of the formation, or were you always in the same place?
Well, we flew in squadrons of 12 airplanes. So we had three squadrons in the group. And you had the group lead, which took care of all three squadrons, and you had a lead pilot in each of, in the high squadron and the low squadron. That was about it.
But physically, was the lead for the whole group in the first plane to be very front?
The lead group flew a little bit ahead of the high and the low, and you as the lead pilot of the higher and the low obviously had to keep watch on the group lead to make sure that you kept the airplanes in the right place there. And the one advantage, one reason for wanting to be a lead pilot was you flew on automatic pilot. Whereas I can recall in those days of flying, particularly flying off the wing of somebody else, coming back and never having felt so tired in my life. And tired enough, Nick didn't mention it, but one of the things in the debriefing process was you got a shot of liquor. And I was never felt good enough to have the shot of liquor, but there were always volunteers to take care of it.
I had a question for each of you, starting with you, Walt. Where were you and how did you celebrate VE Day?
Well, the thing that I remember most about it was there were all sorts of problems with guns going off. There were probably more gunshots on VE Day than there were in all of the war at Thurlow. And there were several people who were hurt. What it led to was on VJ Day, McKinney was our squadron commander and Bill Haas was the operations officer. I was the assistant operations officer. We knew that VJ Day was coming, and the night before we went around and picked up 100% of the weapons. Everything was eliminated to avoid the danger that happened on VE Day.
Mm. Wow.
Steve?
Well, the other fellows need to answer that question, too.
Oh, okay.
You're talking about the end of Germany?
Yeah. Where you were, right.
Okay. I was at Thurlow, and the general that I remember was Turner. And he wanted to celebrate in some way to commemorate all of the things that the British people had done for us while we were there. So they formed a parade down Bedford. The only problem was the band to help us march, because none of us had marched in probably a couple of years. He had us dress in our Class A's, and we all reported out in the column of fours for this parade. But there was no band, like I say, so they had a Scottish bagpipers. If you've ever heard that, I'm sure you have, that there's no downbeat. It's hard to know when to put your left foot down. So one of the guys in rank said, "Hey, Sarge, how about calling cadence so we don't look so bad?" So that really shaped us up, because then we had somebody who could always put the same foot down at the same time. So I always remember that as the final thing for me, although I went into Casey Jones later. I didn't leave Thurlow until October. So, because the 8th Air Force had left, the NCO there in the headquarters told me, "We're going to have to transfer you to the 9th Air Force." And I didn't understand that. And he said, "Well, that's a military way of doing things, you know. The 8th is gone. You're no longer in the 8th. You'll have to take your patch off this shoulder, put it over here, and put the 9th over there." So I ended up having to go to Paris to the headquarters of the 9th Air Force in order to get a ship to come home to America. That's the way it is.
The 9th Aft was, it was headquartered in Schweinfurt, Germany, after we were transferred to the 8th Air Force.
From the 8th Air Force. Talk about
V-E-V.
Where were you?
V-E-Day. I still have a hangover. The CO lined us up all in front of the tower there, and the commanding officer, he rattled on for a while, and he told us the war was over in Europe and all that sort of stuff. And he finally ended up, he says, you're all restricted to the base. Well, it's a good thing he did. It's probably the best thing he ever did, that guy. And we start, right away we broke off all the formations and started down to the mess, the junior officer's mess. And I go in the door, and an arm reaches out and pulls me aside. And it was the mess officer. And he says, wait a minute. And he pulled another one in, a flying man. He took us back in his office. He opened the drawer up and put a bottle of Vigo CO on the desk and three glasses. And we drank that at 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon. That was just the start. This was the hope that Germans could have wiped out the 306. We had something to eat, and then we went into the bar, and we started all over again with some of his fighting friends. And then the CO came in from one of the squadrons and grabbed a whole bunch of us and took us down to their... Each of the squadron CEOs had a private little apartment building or something like that. And he opened the door, and then we considered the drinking. Now, this was started at around 3 o'clock, and this was about 11 o'clock at night. Now, you can imagine how we're feeling. And I said to one of the guys there, I says, where can I sleep? Because the tower was, I lived in the tower, and it was probably half a mile or so up the road. And he shows me a place in one of the barracks. He says, you'll sleep here, this is my barracks, and this man is gone home. So we start back to the party, and I missed a turn. It was still blacked out. And I walked, and I walked. And I saw a checkered Jeep. And I sat down in the checkered Jeep, and it's the last thing I remember. My men picked me up, took me in the tower, carried me up 2 flights of steps and put me in bed, and I woke up the next morning.
Yeah, pass it that way.
There was a couple of things I haven't mentioned. I don't know if you people know about or whatnot. There were some advantages in the Air Force. And what was there, I think you got promoted a lot faster than the foot soldiers did throughout that situation. We had a lot of sergeants and whatnot. I was a tech sergeant, and we had captains, and we had first technical, we had colonels running around. So the Air Force, I think, they were more generous with giving out rank, and that in turn means a few more bucks. The other advantage we had when we were flying personnel in the Air Force is we got additional money for flying. We had to, I think at the time I was there, I had to fly at least 3 hours, and I may get half of my base pay in addition with what I was getting. So that was an advantage too, and so forth. But when the war ended, I was down in Alexandria, Louisiana. I was instructing down there. And I had a radio operator that we were buddies, and I was married, he was married, and we lived in the same place and so forth. And when that happened, we thought we'd like to go out and celebrate. He had a car. And I didn't. So I said, well, gas is rationed. I mean, maybe we would like to go down to New Orleans or something, but we need gas. So Our first project was to find a way to get a couple of 5 gallon cans of 100 octane gas that was burned in the car. And we were lucky. We got a couple of them. We put one in the back and one in the vehicle, and away we went. We went to New Orleans, and we had a good time, you know. And that was my situation at the end of the war, okay?
Thank you.
I guess, Walt, this one's for you. You mentioned how tired you were when you came back from missions. But how much did you share flying the plane with the co-pilot? Did you trade off?
Oh yeah, we traded off, but I would guess that typically the pilot flew at least 2/3 of the time. And certainly over the target, you always flew.
Okay. Did you have any specific times where the co-pilot would fly the plane? Versus the pilot, like you said, the pilot would fly over the target.
Yeah, only because you were at that point in need for the best communication you could have with your crew. You really made the co-pilot fly because every once in a while you needed the co-pilot to fly. I indicated I was wounded on one mission, and the co-pilot had to fly it all the way over the target and back to the base. But it was good to get the co-pilot to fly as much as possible.
One other question about the pilot and the co-pilot. You both went through the exact same training. How was it determined where one guy would be the lead, the first pilot, and another guy would be a co-pilot? Was there any criteria for that, or?
Well, the going through the training process was fascinating. We went through classification center at Nashville, Tennessee. Spent about a month there being tested physically, mentally, etc. And I went through it and qualified as a pilot, navigator, and bombardier. But because I was always good at mathematics, they concluded that I would be better as a navigator. And they talked to me, and I said to them, you know, this is not a career for me, and if you guys think I'd be a better navigator than a pilot, that's what I'll do. And in typical Army fashion, I was off to pilot school a week later. And I was ever grateful because I really much preferred being the pilot. Now, when I went through training, after learning how to fly in a PT-17 in primary flying, and then flew a BT-13 in basic training, they gave us the opportunity to determine whether we'd like to be single-engined or twin-engined pilots. And it was really a question of whether you wanted to be a fighter pilot or a bomber pilot. I never was particularly attracted to aerobatics and came to the conclusion that I'd rather be a bomber pilot. And then in advanced flying, we had the opportunity to look at all of the airplanes, B-24, B-25, B-17. And I concluded after looking at all of them that the B-17 was by far the safest of the airplanes, and concluded that I'd like to be a B-17 pilot. And we then graduated, went off to what they call transition flying to learn how to fly a B-17, and then went on to crew training in Tampa, Florida, where I picked up my crew, and we spent a couple of months getting to know and work with each other. My co-pilot, on the other hand, went through single-engine training. He, by the time he graduated, which was a couple of months after me, they didn't need single engine pilots, and therefore he went through what was probably the worst thing that could happen, not only not being the first pilot, but also being in a four engine airplane that you never really flew in before. But it was just one of those accidental things that happened.
Other questions?
Yeah, This one's to Walt, but kind of on the same line, but the flight officers that were more like the warrants, I know that the 306 and then the 367th, there were some of the flight officers that were lead pilots.
Yes.
The second lieutenants as right seats. How did that happen, that the flight officers got the lead?
Well, I don't know how they ever got to be the lead, but when you, and this was not true when I graduated, but a couple of classes afterwards, they had brought in this flight officer approach. And the flight officer was generally low ranked in the graduating class, and the rest of them were all second lieutenants. And how the guy ever got to be the first pilot, I don't know, because he probably was not sent to transition flying at that point. So I don't really know any answer to that.
I don't know either. It's just the way it happened. I didn't mean the lead. I meant the first pilot, though, too.
Yeah.
Okay. I didn't know if it had to do with experience or more hours.
Hey, a couple more questions, and we promised we'd be out of this room by 4:30, so we'll take a few more questions and let these kind gentlemen have a rest.
For each of the three gentlemen that flew missions, how old were you on your first mission?
My first mission was June of 44. I was born June 2nd, 1923. So that would have made me about 21. Yeah.
What were you doing when you were 21?
As far as that goes, I remember we had several first pilots in the 306 toward the end of the war that were probably 19, going on 20 years old.
I was 18 in 1941 when the war started. And I came to the conclusion that whether I liked it or not, I was going into service. And I decided in August of 1942 to enlist, because I knew if I didn't, I'd wind up in the infantry. And I then went through training, and when I was in 1944, when I got over there, I was age 21, and really had more responsibility at age 21 than I had for the rest of my life, because as a lead pilot, you occasionally couldn't hit the primary or secondary target, and there you were, this 21-year-old kid, deciding what part of the face of the earth you were going to obliterate. And it was a great experience. I probably matured at least 10 years in that year. So by the time I got out, I was comparable to a 21-year-old kid today. I was probably age 31.
I was in my early 19 years old, and I had to kind of do some extra work for my mother so that she would sign off and allow me to go.
What kind of work was that?
You know, do the dishes maybe.
Other questions?
We know that there was a senior officer's mess and a junior officer's mess. What about the enlisted guys? Where did they go?
We had three messes at Fleur-de-Lys, as I recall. We had a senior officer's mess for captains and above. All us guys that were lieutenants and warrant officers and whatever had a junior officer's mess. And the enlisted men had one large mess, both in flying and ground people.
When I became a lead pilot, I was a TO captain. I was the first lieutenant at the time. So I got the privilege of eating in the A mess. And I can tell you that the A mess was a Class A restaurant. There was no question that the best cooks and everybody else was in the A mess, and the food was really so much better. It was amazing. It's a good way to eat.
I've never heard of any complaints from anybody that was in third line. The food was usually very good.
Okay, why don't we, before we go, why don't we all give these fellas a big hand? So for those of you who are here and are interested in going to Temple Square tonight for the rehearsal, it does start, the rehearsal starts at 7:30. There is going to be from here, for those who need it or want